Turn one, sword burn.
So, Riley, did you get everything you wanted for Christmas?
Everything.
Yeah.
I got some. Santa brought me some beer.
Nice.
And a nice hat.
Okay.
And a mug. So yes, and in my stocking I got some Reactin and vitamin B12.
Oh, awesome!
So
wow,
some toothpaste and yeah, all that good stuff.
Yeah, it's funny how like that stuff's a lot more exciting than like you know, like toys or something. Even though toys are still exciting, but it's like more exciting to get like
I love getting new practical Burt's Bees stuff for gifts.
Yeah,
yeah, I love it.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although my brother Colby got me and my brothers Nerf guns.
Oh, that's fun.
Super fun.
Did yeah. you guys play with them?
Yeah, we were shooting targets, and then it was funny because all of us were like stressed out about collecting all the bullets and stuff.
Oh yeah.
It's like don't lose any.
Yeah, that never changes. All right, everybody. Well, welcome to the show. This is Turn One Soul Ring. I'm Kevin.
I'm Riley.
And I'm Ainsley.
And today on the show, we're concluding our two-part series explaining the events depicted in the Magic the Gathering novel, Prophecy. Last week, we explained the early stages of the war between the Kapamu League and the invading Keldon army. We also introduced the former Kapamu League officer turned Keldon slave, Hadad. He was well on his way to Keld by this point in the story. By sea. And finally, we left off with a resupply of mages and ornithopters from Talaria arriving at Teferi's airfield, and Baron and Teferi headed to meet them. So there was a whole bunch of other stuff for the war effort, and all brought by Talaria's ambassador, none other than Baron's wife, Rain. So she's making a reappearance here.
She's great.
When Baron saw her, husband and wife embraced. And by the time they were finished, everyone had dispersed. So they were embracing for quite a while.
Oh, my God.
Leaving only Teferi staring at them.
Like a creeper.
Well, I mean, they're embracing in public. I don't know if you should be doing that, but anyways. The planeswalker approached them and took Rain's hand in greeting.
I'm happy to see you, Rain.
Teferi said as he let go of her hand and gestured that they should enter the offices.
You should have come to Talaria more often, Teferi.
You know that I prefer to take Urza in small doses if possible.
Teferi replied as they arrived at the strategy room.
Urza is rarely there, Teferi. My wife and I manage Talaria. In fact, this is the longest I've been off the island since we battled the Phyrexian for it.
Just in case anyone was confused, that was Baron.
Really? I thought it was Riley. Oh, man.
It was Riley, yeah.
Oh, okay. Baron and Rain are Gerard's mommy and daddy, right?
Hannah's
mommy and
yes,
daddy.
Yes, Gerard's mother and father are like super, super side characters. They're dead, too.
Excellent.
So, the three of them discussed and came up with a plan to deal with the Keldons already on Jamura. Teferi introduced Baron and Rain to Joriel, also known as the Empress of Beasts in Jamura.
Sick.
Yeah, she's pretty sexy.
Beast mode.
And that's just like a sweet title, too.
Yeah. So they plan to use Joriel's control over animals for reconnaissance. Rain would also assist her in the task with a group of about 40 artifact creatures brought from Talaria called Runners. Sort of like a pair of legs that you could ride around on, but they could also just run around themselves. And I think they could communicate with each other and then also with Rain. I think they don't get into too much detail of them in this book, but I think if I remember correctly, they do get into a lot more detail about like what they are and how they're made in time streams. Because I'm pretty sure that's like where they're when they were invented, when like Urza invented them. But anyways, Rain would also she had to be on the ground commanding them with Joriel. So once they had a clear picture of what they were dealing with, they could better plan where to strike from the air. That process took 3 weeks, and in that time, the two women discovered a small Keldon camp of about 30 warriors and slaves. Joriel snuck up on the group and overheard that they were heading to a staging area for the next offensive in the war, and naturally, she wanted to capture one and find out more. And that's when something weird happened. As she watched the Keldons and their slaves, they all began to smell an intoxicating odor. It was difficult for her to stay still and not give her position away, but when the Keldons suddenly left their camp and followed the smell, she joined them.
What is that smell?
What she found was the Keldons fervently grabbing, biting, and eating a felled, rotting, and dead tree. The slaves followed shortly thereafter, and they were just as hungry for the tree as their masters.
What?
I'm hungry for a tree.
Give me some of that tree.
I did just actually for Christmas, speaking of getting beer for Christmas, I got some cider for Christmas. And like one is called like something cherry and one is called, you know, something, some other fruit. Mm-hmm. And one is tree flavored.
No one wants that.
So I'm curious.
What what kind of tree?
Rotting, fallen down tree.
Is it cherry? So in their desire to get at the tree, they used the knives. These are the slaves. They used the knives they'd used to prepare food to stab their masters. The small kitchen knives weren't enough to best the Keldons, though. They still had enough sense to turn from the tree and kill the slaves. But then the Keldon mounts wanted to eat the tree.
You just can't win with these people. Like, our butter knives didn't work. What are we going to do?
Horses, mules, and a horned hoofed beast native to Keld called a kolos. They were almost twice the size of any horse. And when those things wanted to get at the tree, they used their curled horns to tear apart the other animals and men still feasting.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
Just looks like a big mountain goat.
He's cute.
Yeah. It's cool. I'd ride one.
I'd rather ride one than be torn apart by one.
The Keldons eventually brought the kolos down, but by the time it was over, only a few mules, men, and warriors still lived. And they weren't hungry. But the danger was far from over. Jorhael, still watching, saw something at the edge of the depression where all this took place. A massive form was grasping a horse corpse. It's a tough one. She put it all together. The lure of the tree, the self-destruction of the Keldon party, the gargantuan beast. This place was a thresher beast trap, and it had caught a full load.
Oh, God. So he just made the tree taste delicious?
Yeah, it's like, it's a lure. It's a thresher beast lure.
So is it... Do these creatures typically like to eat trees, or he like sprinkled something on it that made it delicious?
He sprinkles something on the tree, waits for the, you know, some fauna or some flora to get interested in the tree. In this case, it was dudes and horses. Mm. And then when they're all just crazy about the tree, he comes in and starts eating the people or
trees,
the horses.
Got me looking so crazy
right now. Yeah, I feel like Keldons are like... I'm not too familiar with Keldon cuisine, but I imagine it's not just random tree in the middle of the field.
No.
You know?
No. So a thresher beast was a big tentacled blob looking thing that lived underground. It would surface for food, and because of its size, it could surface surrounding its victim or victims. So the beast began to pull the dead beneath the ground for later consumption. And while the surviving Keldons were figuring out what to do, Jorhael grabbed some plants from the surrounding area and ran to find the rest of her scouting party. The plants were natural suppressants to the intoxicating substance the thresher beast had left on the tree. And as she ran, she wove the plants into garlands that could be worn around one's neck.
Wow, she's just like running and braiding at the same time. That's really impressive.
She's very talented. She found Rain and the rest of her party and explained the situation to them. She gave them all garlands, and they headed back into the forest to catch a Keldon. When they arrived, another thresher beast had joined the fray, and they turned their attention from the dead to the living. By that point, only half of the 12 survivors still lived. Jorhael's party was only 6 strong. It consisted of herself, Rain, a healer named Shalanda, and three league scouts. In the end, they were able to capture a single Keldon, and the others were killed by the beast, as well as 2 of the League scouts. Shalanda was able to kill the beasts by turning a tiny falling twig into a giant piece of wood that crushed them. She that can heal can also make it ill.
Sweet.
And after the fight, Jolrael and Shalanda explained to Rain that under normal circumstances, they both should have been able to control the beasts. When they tried, they felt a severance from them as well as from the ground around them, which is why Shalanda had to use a falling twig to magically manipulate. Was the Keldon presence having some effect on the flora and fauna of Jamura, or was it something more sinister altogether?
That is the question. Yeah.
So, whatever the cause, it was something Rain wanted to investigate further. But anyway, with their Keldon prisoner bound and drugged, they headed for the League base camp, where the prisoner was put into a proper stockade, and the remaining members of the party got a solid night's rest. Save for Jolrael, of course, because she lived in the wild. Although she probably did get a solid night's rest. The next morning saw Rain and Shalanda inside the camp's cramped headquarters. They were there with the camp's commander, a small and fat man named Prigit. He sat behind a large desk, and in front of it sat a small table with all manner of torture devices on it. And there was also a small unlit stove, presumably to aid in the torture. Prigit was planning an interrogation, and just as he explained that to Rain and Shalanda, four League soldiers herded the Keldon prisoner into the room and chained him to a chair in front of Prigit's desk. Prigit began to explain to the Keldon that he would have to answer for his crimes against the League and the people of Jamura, but the Keldon, whose name was revealed to be Korik, brushed that off and shouted to everyone in the room that his army was massing for a final strike that would crush the League.
You're gonna get crushed. Mm.
Prigit demanded to be silenced, but as one of the League soldiers raised a club to bludgeon Korik, he strained against the chains binding him and began shouting some kind of Keldon chant.
This is me?
This is you, yeah. And this is going to be in chunks, so like I'll just pause when it's time for the next one, because there's like kind of five of them in quick succession.
All right.
The first wind of ascension is Forger, burning away in purity.
Then a burst of flame erupted below Korik, and his arms and legs separated from the chains holding him. Everyone in the room froze as the massive Keldon warrior studied them. Then, Prigit ordered his soldiers to pacify him. Soldiers hesitated at first, considering their chances against the 7-foot-tall Keldon. Then they attacked en masse. Korik easily bested the four soldiers while continuing his chant.
The second wind of ascension is Reaver, slaying the unworthy.
More soldiers poured into the room, but by that point, Korik had lifted a fallen soldier's polearm to fight them off, while that's right, continuing his chant.
The third wind of ascension is Eliminator, clearing Kelt's path to victory.
Rain screamed that someone should grab a webcaster, a weapon that fired a net against its target. She was also trying to move closer to Prigit, hoping to use his massive desk as cover. Shalanda was closer to the door and struggled to get through the flow of incoming soldiers and find something to subdue the Keldon. Prigit, who'd hoped to glean as much military intelligence from Korik as possible, finally ordered the soldiers to kill him. And guess what? Korik thought of that order. Chant.
The fourth wind of ascension is Anointer, defying the worthy.
Then he turned to face Prigit and Rain and threw himself at the massive desk. They both retreated toward the wall behind the desk, leaving himself unprotected to the soldiers behind him. They sunk a whole bunch of spears into his back. Don't worry, though. He finished his chant.
The fifth wind of ascension is Exalter, fulfilling Keld's destiny.
The full force of the Keldon slamming into the heavy desk was visited upon Prigit, crushing him to death. Rain would have suffered the same fate, but just as the Keldon sacrificed his defenses to kill Prigit and Rain, Shalanda had returned with Baron. He didn't have time to save both of them, so he made the obvious choice and saved his wife by using a spell to pull her out of the path of the desk. The soldiers continued to stab the Keldon in case he got up again. He didn't, though, of course. Face to face with Prigit, he said,
"Even a chained Keldon can kill one such as you."
Then he died smiling at the fat man. And needless to say, they really didn't get a lot of information out of him. Baron probably could have saved both of them, but he's like, ooh, you know. The war continued, and as it did, it took Baron to Arsenal City, where he met the Jamuran General Majetta. The first thing Baron noticed was the man's size. He was larger than many of Keldon's Baron had seen, although his features were far less severe than the invaders. I gotta say, I remember this card from when I was a kid, and I wasn't sure it was altogether human, and I think his creature type is like Spellshaper or something, so certainly doesn't look human. It's got weird hands.
Yeah, it's probably been errated since then.
Yeah, I should have checked. So the general was known as the Lion by his men for his ferocity in battle, but also because he tended to wear skins, animal skins. On top of that, he was also on the front lines and in the heat of battle with his men, which isn't the most strategic place to be for one commanding an army, but that tends to happen a lot in fiction. So after meeting Magetta, he showed off his legion of steel ants, mantises, and crabs. The league didn't contain enough able-bodied Jamurans and had to be supplemented by a lot of artifact creatures, which we mentioned in the first episode. We really don't need to get into too... Oh, Evie. Evie, girl.
She wants to snug in your lap.
So we don't need to get into too much detail about the crabs and mantises because I really don't think it's that interesting. But they're basically just metal versions of their organic counterparts, but like a whole lot bigger. And I think we did mention their size in part one of this series. But they were preparing for a fight, and although Baron didn't want to take an active part in battle, he used his ornithopter to oversee. The League army, made up of mostly metal soldiers, was amassing outside of Arsenal City, waiting for a force of Keldons about 4,000 strong. Baron was flying above and watched the Keldons approach. Many were on foot, traveling with some cavalry and about 30 land barges. It was also impossible to tell how many of them were slaves, which was always something that they kind of considered when they were in battle because... they didn't want to kill their own people. So, all things considered, Baron thought it would be a victory for the League. But even with Magetta leading them from the front lines, the League was overwhelmed and was forced to retreat back to Arsenal City, not without the Keldons also taking heavy losses. They also would have followed Magetta and the rest of the League back to Arsenal City if it weren't for Baron. He wanted to stay out of the fight, but he was so disappointed and pissed off at how easily the League was beaten, he took all that emotion and sent it into the ground. He drove it deeper underground to where the Keldons were pursuing the League forces, then drove it even deeper, causing a sinkhole, and then a landslide beneath the Keldons' feet. So it wasn't the largest hole, but a few land barges and many warriors were swallowed by it, and presumably quite a few slaves. And it wasn't meant to cripple the army, only stop their pursuit. And as Baron flew toward Arsenal City, he knew he would have to take the same command of ground forces he had for air if the League had any hope of winning the war. Why doesn't he just do that all the time?
Yeah.
Just make a sinkhole under the opposing army.
I mean, if it ain't broke.
It'd be too easy.
Yeah, it would be too easy. By that point in the story, many weeks had passed, and Haddad had finally arrived in Keld. Many more weeks would pass before Haddad was woken from stasis, though. That's what he thought, anyway.
Ooh.
What actually occurred was that Latula had awoken him with the rest of the ship's crew, but she had wiped his mind clean of memories from the previous weeks. During that time, she'd surgically attached a copper ring around his right bicep. Small metal wires protruded from the ring into Haddad's arm, eventually connecting to his nervous system. With the ring attached, Latula could inflict excruciating pain on Haddad with a thought. If she pushed hard enough, she could even kill him. As for the rest of Haddad's missing time, Latula had put him to work rebuilding Lord Druick, remember the Keldon leader who was also an amputee from part one? After his run-in with the gastro jelly, he was pretty much a torso with a head. So Latula put Haddad to work rebuilding building new mechanical limbs for Druick, as well as a sort of exoskeleton for the man that he could pilot. These details were something Haddad wouldn't be aware of until later in the story. So the point at which Haddad's post-stasis memories began was when he woke up in a dark bedroom, laying on a bed, fully clothed.
Ooh.
Which means someone had to have dressed him.
He's like, I don't usually wear pants.
It would probably be like really hard to dress someone who's just like kind of dead to the world, like just like dead weight.
Oh yeah, it would be. It would be very hard.
Just like work with me a little bit. So there was a single window in the room. And he opened the curtains to see his first Keldon city. It was really just a cluster of buildings with foot-beaten paths leading to and away from them. There were no streets except a single stone pathway through the city leading to a series of bare hills in the distance. Haddad thought it was eerily quiet and lifeless until he saw a few Keldons and slaves milling about. Not just human slaves, either. There were dwarves, elves, and a few other Hadad could only guess at. You've all been there. Having a rudimentary understanding of what lay beyond the bedroom door, Hadad found his shoes, put them on, and opened it. What he found was a Keldon female of middle age. Her name was Iola, and she was the master of Lachila's household, while the artificer was away from Keld. Oh yeah, she's also not in Keld currently. She explained that they were, in fact, in Lachila's mansion. Iola then led Hadad to his workshop, housed in a different building. On their way, they passed a cradle house, and Iola explained what it was. We went over that in part one.
Mm-hmm.
It's really creepy and awful.
Yep.
Then they arrived at the workshop. Iola took him to the second floor and explained that Hadad was to spend his days rebuilding steel ants from salvaged parts sent from the Jamurin front. Replacing and repairing small systems of the war machines was Hadad's former job as an officer. Rebuilding whole models was out of his league, his Kipamu league, probably. I just thought of that. not that he said that to Iola. He simply got to work. Because if you don't work, you get beat.
You won't get beat.
Over the following several days, Hadad began to plan his escape once again. And he planned to use his cannibalized steel ant to do it. He would certainly be able to rely on his own creation more than any other slave in Keld. And that was when he remembered a piece of advice two nameless men had given him. So you guys have to try and say this at the same time.
Okay, give us like a 3-2-1 countdown.
Okay. So on one, you do it. So 3-2-1.
Seek to escape and trust no one.
You know what? I'll just do it in post. It's all good.
You'll do it in post. Yeah. It'll be fine.
Good advice though, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, Hadad was working so hard that he dozed off, and when he woke, it was dark outside. I mean, that's like every Saturday for me.
No.
You
just
go to, you lay on the couch at 11 a.m. for a nap, and boom, Saturday's gone. So he began to gather his things and head back to Lachila's house when he heard a rustling from the floor below him. He found a depression in the floor where he could actually see through the first floor of the workshop, and he saw one of the cradle house attendants and a boy that looked to be no more than 8 years old. Hadad overheard that the woman's name was Arissa and the boy was named Greel. Arissa explained to Greel he would be traveling to Jamura when Lachila returned.
I don't know why I need to head south. I'm happy here. There'll be no children for me to play with. Surely Lachila needs no watcher over her.
Arissa, great voice, by the way, Riley. Arissa punched the boy so hard that the rings on her fingers tore his flesh. Hadad noticed no blood spilling from the wounds. Then he watched as gashes began to close and the wounds healed.
Whoa. That got heavy pretty quick.
Yeah, right? He just wants kids to play with.
It's time to put your childhood behind you. You will find new playmates among the League and our less fervent supporters. Now, I have a treat for you.
Is it chocolate?
Ooh, treats!
Probably another punch in the face.
She opened her cloak to reveal a sleeping baby in a sling, and Hadad knew something was terribly wrong.
Oh my god.
This is teen fiction right here. Arissa unstrapped the child and laid it down in front of Greel. The boy hopped onto a nearby crate, opened his mouth, and inhaled. His mouth opened wider and wider like a snake swallowing an egg.
Oof.
As he did, it felt like all life and warmth was sucked from the room. Hadad thought he might freeze to death and wondered why Arissa seemed unaffected by Greel's feeding technique. I think it was magic, probably. And just like that, it was over. Greel seemed like a boy once more, although he was larger and his features were more mature, more rugged. The baby, on the other hand, was completely still, and Hadad knew it wasn't sleeping. R.I.P. baby.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So he just, like, sucks the life force from it and like, gets big. So then Arissa and Greel made their exit. Hadad waited a long time before he found his way back to his room. That'll put hair on your chest, that's for sure. Several days passed, and in that time, Hadad finished constructing a working steel ant. He'd also watched several funeral processions from the window of his workshop. Funerals for babies.
Oh my god.
R.I.P. babies.
Oh, I don't like it.
He wasn't sure what Greal was or what kind of dark magic Arissa was practicing, but the boy's growth was plain to see. Soon he would be the size of a warrior. A man.
I'm a real man.
The day Haddad completed the ant was the same day that Latila returned to the city. She was pleased at his progress, so pleased that she performed a gruesome demonstration with the mechanical creature. She displayed her own control over the ant by using it to eviscerate and amputate an unsuspecting dog.
Jesus.
R.I.P. little doggy.
This is rough.
This is a rough
episode. What is happening?
I told you guys this is going to be rough.
I thought you meant, like, you know, people would be dying, not babies and puppies.
Oh, people, characters we love are going to die, too.
Oh, so, great. This is just the appetizer.
She also displayed her control over Haddad's armband by inflicting crippling pain on the man. It was then that Haddad began to lose all hope of ever escaping Keldon's servitude. R.I.P. Hope. So, at the top of the series, we mentioned the Keldons were invading Jamora for Tufa. What we didn't mention is what Tufa meant to them beyond fueling their war machines. Keldon history basically stated that they once fought and ruled most of Dominaria, and as they did, every Keldon that fell in battle soaked the earth with their blood. The blood stayed in the ground and turned into Tufa. I don't think there's actually any, like, scientific background to back that up, because it's probably just, like, a fossil fuel. But so not only was the substance sacred and powerful for the Keldons, for their enemies to use it was sacrilegious. Another detail we didn't mention was that the ruling houses of Keld were split on how exactly to proceed with the invasion. Some wanted to do it the practical way, and some, like Latila, wanted to awaken the Witch Kings of the past to reinvigorate the old ways. And if you're not familiar with those ways, you should go back and listen to our Bloodline series where we first introduced the Keldons. In that series, we also explained the fall of Gatha, R.I.P. Gatha, and his genetically engineered Witch Kings. It's actually a pretty good story. I think it's my favorite part of that particular book. So that left a power vacuum in Keld that was filled by the current rulers of the country. And in their struggle to take control, they tried to eradicate any trait of Gatha's influence, meaning that they killed anyone they considered a Gathan, is what they were called. That period was appropriately referred to as the Gathan War. And I don't think Latula and her ilk wanted to awaken decades-long corpses, but I do think they thought they could glean information from the dead Witch Kings and attempt to recreate them with science. And I think they don't really explain too much about what Greal is, but I think there's probably a connection there, just like kind of weird science.
Sure.
Or weird science mixed with magic, whatever.
Just a real Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Yeah, he's going to be big. Shortly after Latula's return, she traveled with a sizable Keldon party to the Keldon Necropolis. And if you're not familiar with the Necropolis, it was basically the former Keldon seat of government and where many of the former rulers of Keld were entombed, and it was built into a mountain. When they arrived, they were met at the entrance. They were met by the entrance of the Council Hall, a mighty fortress with walls 30 feet high, great towers supported the corners of the walls, and the gatehouse sat at the bottom of a steep ramp leading to the central keep. The heart of the fortress jutted directly out of the mountain rock, as if the mountain had half swallowed the building. No one was visible, and the gates were closed. Latula, leading her supporters, stopped, looking for someone to announce her.
I seek an audience with the council.
A small door opened on the side of the mountain, and a woman stepped out. She wore a gray cloak with a hood thrown back, her dress a faded red. An iron shod staff was in her hands, its half covered in runes. Her face appeared unlined, and only her voice hinted at her age as she spoke. More like her weight, right, Riley?
I, Gorsha, greet you. As a servant to the Witch King Council, I await your reasoning for intruding.
It is time to march. Time to take control of our destiny and wake the Witch Kings of old.
Then Latula's supporters began chanting, wake the kings, wake the kings. Gorsha raised her staff and brought it down on the stone cobbles. The resulting noise was a scream that silenced Latula's supporters.
Very impressive.
But shouts will not wake the kings, or they would have risen long ago. The council finds you unpersuasive and foolish.
Then you shall have proof that I can do what I have promised. Many of the witch kings are shattered in body and must be healed before they can rise. I present Lord Druick to prove that such miracles are possible.
So up to that point in their journey, Druick had been concealed in a Kolos-drawn carriage. But at Latula's command, the Keldon emerged to show Gorsha and the rest of them Haddad's handiwork. He was as crippled as ever, but Haddad and Latula had built a suit of armor he could pilot. As Haddad studied the armor, he noticed a round lump on the chest plate. That lump housed the Power Stone, and that's when many of Haddad's memories of building the armor rushed back to him. Anyway, everyone was pretty impressed, save for Gorsha, and she let Latula know she wasn't going to let any of them pass.
I will not back down. The kings will rise under my hands.
Latula's demands are rejected. Her mad schemes are to be opposed by all true sons and daughters of Keld. I challenge her now. Win, and the council might hear your plea, but lose, and your cause falls with you. Your supporters will depart, and never again will a crowd cry to wake the kings.
I accept. Let the strongest prevail.
Lady fights. With that, the two women led Latula's party to a wide open space near the necropolis and tested their magical prowess against one another. The two slung all manner of fire spells at each other, and at one point, Latula had the upper hand, but Gorsha was the more skilled mage. She ended the contest by creating a shockwave that surrounded Latula and the Keldon party. It encased them in flame, and Latula was only able to save those closest to her. Even Lord Druick, who had survived the blast, had been left limbless once again. The result of the shockwave left a giant chasm in the earth, and Gorsha kicked what was left of Druick into it.
Jeez.
R.I.P. Druick.
Yeah.
I think I'm limbless once again. He's just rolling down there, just his little torso. Aww,
rough.
The other Keldons, who were loyal to the power, who were loyal to power above all else, moved to throw Latula into the same hole until Gorsha stopped them.
She has failed. Let her and her servants die and wither in far-off lands. Let her never leave Jamura as long as I draw breath. The strongest has prevailed, and the witch kings shall not be disturbed again by any in this company.
And just like that, Latula and everything she had was banished to Jamura to succeed and conquer the continent or fail.
Hmm.
Classic.
Bye, yep. Bitch.
So, going back to Jamura, Baron was once again in Arsenal City with Magetta. They had just survived one of the largest Keldon offensives during the war. They had not only survived, with the help of Teferi's air force, they had forced the Keldons to retreat. Over the following weeks, the League was successful in pushing the Keldons back to the coast, and Baron planned to push them further. And once they were expelled from Jamura, he planned to use Teferi's air force to blow them out of the water. And that's exactly what he did, meaning that Latula and her crew arrived in a far more dangerous environment. Mm-hmm. They had all been put into stasis shortly after Latula's defeat at Gorsha's hands, then shipped to the Keldon coast. The rest of Latula's house and those loyal to her were also sealed in stasis. Then they were put on a ship and sent to Jamura. That trip took weeks, and by that point, the Keldon invasion had become a Keldon retreat. Latula was surprised when she and her crew were woken before landfall. The captain of their ship told her it was a safety precaution. The League was bombing ships approaching the coast, so they needed everyone on board awake in case they had to swim. Luckily for them, they docked without incident. Latula was now in control of the Jamuran campaign once again, and she decided she would use that opportunity to build a new Keld, one that was loyal to the Witch Kings. Then maybe, once she was powerful enough, she would return to the necropolis and get him. Who can say? She doesn't really expand on that part of it. That's just my own... Anyway, while Latula was constructing a personal empire, Teferi used magic to force a destructive storm over a Keldon coastal colony, killing thousands, while Baron and Magetta continued their campaign eastward, chasing the retreating Keldon army. With news of all this, Latula decided to gather her warriors and head west to intercept the retreating Keldons. She planned to rally as many warriors as she could and cause as much damage as she could. The group Baron and Magetta were pursuing had split in two, so Rain volunteered to go after one half. Alexei was in command of a flotilla of blimps that were also following the retreating Keldons. Baron ordered her to drop half her bombs onto the Keldons. She reported that the strike destroying 90% of the larger barges and 50% of the smaller ones. Then Baron sent Alexei's flotilla to intercept the Keldons Rain was after. Baron also gave Rain a crystal that he would pulse twice when Alexei's flotilla was closing in on the Keldons she was after, and then pulse one single time when Alexei was about to drop the other half of the payload on them. That left Baron and Magetta to deal with Latula. The Keldon artificer had brought Greel with her, all the way from Keld, and she had dispatched him to connect with the Keldons Rain was after. But they both found each other before the Keldons, and a brutal fight ensued, just as Baron pulsed the crystal twice.
Ooh, snap.
Yeah. So Rain was piloting a Talarian runner, and when the crystal pulsed once more, the first bombs detonated around them. She was thrown from the runner at high speed and approached the ground, turning in midair. She came down on her side. Her arm and ribs shattered as they contacted the soil, and her body flipped over and hit once more.
Oof.
Her pelvis and legs broke as she slid to a stop. Oh. The pain hit her like a sledgehammer, and she gasped.
Just like, that's it.
My entire body's broken. Ow.
Well, I'm not sure how much pain you'd actually feel in that state. Like, if you've ever broken a bone, you know, it's like not immensely painful right away.
Yeah, like when you broke your collarbone and like took all your
I took off a pullover sweater. Yeah, like right after. Anyways, so she's laying on the ground. She's facing Greel, and Greel is smiling, his flesh remolding itself after the blast. He advanced on her, and shock enveloped her senses, and she knew she was going to die. She thought of her daughter and the decades she had been with Baron. So many years of happiness and love.
It was a good life,
she whispered and closed her eyes. Then Greel consumed all that she was, and that's all she wrote for Rain. Oh, R.I.P. Rain.
That's sad. Oof.
Yeah.
That's very sad.
I love you. Yeah, it's even more sad because they're like kind of quasi-immortal, like Rain and Baron. But anyways, all that being said, the airstrike destroyed most of the other half of the Keldon retreat, which again left Baron and Magetta to deal with Latula and her ilk. Following the airstrike, Baron and Magetta's detachment mopped up what was left of the retreating Keldons, and that's when he discovered his wife's body. And she was headless, too, at this point. He like, cut off her head. But they don't go into that detail. That's just how he finds her. As awful as what Baron went and will have to go through for the rest of his story, I do love his kind of punisher, the sort of vengeance-style Baron that results from these events. And out loud he said, I guess, oh, yeah, because, right, yeah, out loud he said,
they're dead. They'll all burn.
And that's when Greel piped up.
So is just to get this straight, is Greel like a big boy now? Like he's no longer.
No, do the kid voice.
Is he still again. A kid? Oh God.
No, I mean in like mind, he's still a kid. But yeah, he's like a big scary thing.
Okay.
There isn't enough rage and hate in the world to burn me. I killed her, and now I'll get to kill you.
Yeah, I love it. And that's when Greel tried to suck the life from Baron. But like I said, only vengeance would matter for the wizard going forward. He unleashed a killing wave, destroying Greel and almost everything in its path. It even intercepted Latula and her fleet of land barges, stopping them in their tracks and killing many. Not Latula, though. As Baron waded through the destruction he'd unleashed, he came upon her. The lower half of the artificer's body had been crushed beneath her overturned land barge. And when she saw him, she thought him a slave.
Dig me free. Hurry, slave, or I'll have you beaten.
Classic threat. Now, the book doesn't exactly describe what happened after that, but when Magetta and a platoon of Marines found Baron an hour later, the old wizard was sitting near the barge and Latula's head had been severed from her broken body. Magetta, so RIP, Latula. We can RIP bad guys. Magetta had also found Rain's body, so he didn't need to ask Baron what had happened. He explained the Keldons were in full retreat and went on to ask,
"What should we do now? There are still warriors on plains and small detachments across Jamura. What are your orders?"
Thinking of Rain and the decades of loving memories they shared, his response was chilling.
"No quarter, no prisoners."
Yeah! Yeah, that's good. I like that one. Somebody's just like, nah, let's just kill them all. So I bet you're all wondering what happened to Haddad. Well, he was aboard Latula's barge, but he'd survived Baron's attack and was found by Shalanda, who successfully removed his armband. Not without, well, the results of her removing the armband through magic caused her to fall into a coma that she's still in at the end of the story. So I don't know what's going to happen to her, but anyways, the war was over. Teferi had been successful in obliterating the Keldon colonies along the coast, while Baron and Magetta took care of the Keldons left inland. And that's pretty much the end of prophecy, except that mysterious severance from the land Jolrael and Shalanda felt earlier in the story. It turns out a plague was spreading across Jamura, but it was no ordinary plague.
It was a coronavirus.
It was a coronavirus plague. After some investigation, Rain, Shalanda, and Jolrael had deduced that it was mostly organic and likely naturally occurring, but there was a mechanical aspect to it that no one could explain. Something Phyrexian, perhaps. And I really don't know. Like, I'm just, that would be fun. And that's prophecy.
Hmm.
And also the completion of the masquerade cycle of novels. So we did it, guys.
There you go. R.I.P. Wow.
R.I.P.
Masquerade
cycle. Yeah. Yeah. R.I.P. like R.I.P. also Baron being a nice guy ever again.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you kill someone's love.
Yeah. So we were planning on moving right on to the invasion cycle with the titular novel Invasion next. But we thought before we get to the part of the story that this has all been leading to, we should go back in time to our villain's earlier years. And I'm, of course, talking about Yawgmoth and the MTG novel The Thran, which we'll be covering next in our lore series.
Nice.
So we'll get to know Yawgmoth and how he got his powers and became such a douchebag. Turns out he was kind of just born a sociopath, but we'll explain that when we continue our lore series in a few weeks. But other than that, thank you both for your lovely acting skills, all your voices. I'm looking forward to editing this episode. And it always makes me smile. And we'll talk to you people next week.
You people.
Sometimes you're born with it. Sometimes it's Phyrexian.
That's right. Well, he was very good looking. He could have been on like those Maybelline commercials.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Pictures of him. He's pretty sexy. And that's also how they describe him in the book, especially that feet washing scene that I mentioned to you guys. I'll elaborate on that more in the future. Yeah, until then, just take it easy out there and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
All the best in 2022.
Hey, pandemic's over too.
Oh, yeah. Right on. Yeah, effective December 31st.
Yep.
That's the expiry date.
Yeah, we'll all go home.
All right, bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye now.
Bye.